So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to the Engadget podcast. I'm reviews editor Sherlyn Lowe, and today, instead of my usual co-host Devendra Hardwar, who's off on break, I am joined by UK bureau chief and generally fairly charming person, Matt Smith. Hi.
Hi. Charming for 1 hour per day, that's the limit.
Yeah,
you get the entire hour here, right here, right now.
Yes, and Matt is here to talk with me about all the news that happened this week, with a major focus obviously on Google's Pixel 5 event, or they called it Launch Night In, and it was actually nighttime in the UK, I think, when it was happening. Microsoft also unveiled a bunch of new Surface devices. We're going to talk about that as well. But also, Matt Smith, you know, your review of the iOS 14 software, I guess, just went up this week too, so we're going to tell people what you thought about that. Cool. As usual, if you're liking this show, please subscribe to the Engadget podcast on your podcast catcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes, because that'll help more people discover and hopefully like us. And yeah, if you have more thoughts, you can always send a long, rambly email to podcast@engadget.com. So on Wednesday, Google had its Launch Night In event, which, again, like I said, people were pointing out that it was not nighttime, but I don't think Google really cares. And they unveiled, as we expected, the new Chromecast with Google TV, the new Nest audio speaker, as well as the Pixel 5 and Pixel 4a 5G. Now that we've had some time to sit with the news and kind of like think about what we feel about these products, Matt, what are your thoughts? Like, what stood out to you?
I like the look of everything. Just aesthetic-wise, like that new Chromecast is really cute, very stylish, really slick. The Nest audio speaker also looks really cute. A selection of colors. I think the main take home was we knew all this was coming. There was nothing. The only thing exciting, and I see it in your notes, was that the Pixel 5 comes in a really pretty color.
green that I'm wearing today.
I mean, I realized like I'm already on trend, because that's my iPhone case color as well. This looks like it could be a Pixel 5.
Yeah, it might be.
I'm just showing this on the YouTube stream for podcast people. They won't know what the hell.
Oh, yeah. And speaking of, actually, I should have shouted this out earlier, but those of you who are listening to the podcast, if you want to join us on Thursdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on the Engadget YouTube channel, we do live recordings of the Engadget podcast where you can shoot your questions directly at us and have them answered in between segments. Anyway, so yeah, the Pixel 5 and 4a 5G, I think, is what most people were excited to see. However, I think most people also came away disappointed with what was actually in the phones. This is like a $699. So the Pixel 5 is the so-called flagship model, and it's $699. You get 5G for the price and an ultra-wide camera, which I am stoked for or happy about. But then like a Snapdragon 765 processor, which I think the chip nerds and the hardware nerds are pretty upset about. Does that bother you, Matt?
Not at all. Like, I think the Pixel 4a, which we've both played with, and I have one somewhere on my desk somewhere right now that I can't see, but that has a very modest processor, as did the OnePlus Nord that I reviewed recently. I think it is the power users, the kind of people that, you know, watched this event last night and had opinions immediately.
Right,
like,
right.
They're very, you know, they have very high standards. So yeah, if you have high standards, the 765G is not going to be as good as, say, an 865, which is like the fancy processor you're seeing in the top drawer Samsung phones, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And even the S20 FE, the fan edition, which I believe is going for about $600, is using an 865 with triple cameras. So there's a lot of comparison to that phone there. We can get into that a little bit later. But you were saying?
It was just funny how much they took away from the Pixel 4 in comparison to the Pixel 5. So, I mean, let's run through it. So the main things is they've got rid of this, you know, hugely trumpeted 5 years in development Soli radar module, right? So that means no face unlock and none of those, hands-free motion sense controls. Like, Cher, you've you didn't use the Pixel 4 for a while because it wasn't face detecting you, right? Like,
yeah, I actually held off on using the Pixel 4 as my main because the face unlock was so bad. But I will say Google has rolled out updates in the past few months that make it a lot better. Actually, I can even unlock it with a mask on now.
Well, that's good. Yeah. So, but yeah, the main, like, motion sense controls, I did not go near them whatsoever. Like,
yeah, it was like kind of annoying too, and I think also causing battery drain, which is a huge issue with Pixels in general.
Yeah.
So I can see why they removed it, in part because A, it seemed like it wasn't doing very much. To be a little harsh, it seemed like it was pretty useless. B, it was a battery drain, right? And C, it's like a component that would be expensive to add in a flagship.
So like there's a lot of wins here. And you know, it's a net good for the Pixel 5 compared to the Pixel 4. And like you said, battery, that's another thing that we do know about, that the Pixel 5 comes with a much bigger, I think, 4,000 milliamp hour battery.
Yeah. Which is, we're finally starting with a 4.
Yeah, right? Like, I think the 4 was like, I want to say like 3.2 or 3.4, 3,400 or so.
Yeah, 33-ish. I don't know the specs offhand right now.
But the point is, this is a huge jump up. And that's like, you know, those final hours of the day where you just want your phone to last till you're back at your apartment, right? That's those core hours of use you want. So then, again, it's still good stuff.
It is, but as is usual for Google, they've used like software to make up for poor hardware, or not poor hardware, but like, you know, limited hardware. And in this case, I think this, with the Pixel 5, they also announced this thing called Extreme Battery Saver Mode, which to me is like, I don't know if I want my phone to be that basic just to get a few extra, you know, minutes or hours out of it. It's going to like kill all but essential functions, it seems like. And I don't know how much more use that'll be than an already existing battery saver mode.
Yeah, just put more battery in the thing. Like, why? We've seen these extreme, you know, battery saving modes on other phones, often Android phones. And it is, you can like barely get to SMS, maybe email, phone calls.
Yeah.
If you're lucky, WhatsApp is often included. But that's not why you have your phone. You have your phone to take photos, to watch Netflix on, you know, the train home. You've got it to listen to podcasts or read a Kindle book on. Right. You don't want this really basic functionality. It's all but having a dead phone.
Yeah. Like, who's even taking calls anymore? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I try not to either. But it's weird. This is a weird approach. I do think, though, it seems like they sacrifice quite a bit just to have a 5G phone that comes under $700. We had a little like roundtable, me and a few reporters had a roundtable meeting with Hardware Chief Rick Osterloh right after the event. And a lot of us asked him that question, like, this is weird. Are you not doing flagships anymore? And Osterloh was like, no, that's not that's not beyond the realm of possibility. And like someone was saying, you know, did you have plans to make a phone like this before COVID struck, or was this kind of a pivot because this year just doesn't make sense economically to make a flagship level phone? And I think Osterloh said something along the lines of, no, we couldn't predict a pandemic and this has been in the works for about a year. So it looks like Google's approach may be to focus on giving people like a good phone for like a reasonable price. And then it's interesting to see what they choose to leave out in that case, right?
Yeah, like my, I've put my conspiracy theory hat somewhere else. But if I had it on, my entire, it makes complete sense why they made the Pixel 5 cheaper and they made a 4A twice. You know, the 4A and the 4A 5G. It's because the 3A was such a hit for them last year. I think you did the report on the earnings, right, Cher? And they sold like double the amount of phones when they launched the 3A.
Might have been Nate who did that report, but they sold a lot of Pixel 3As and also have sold a lot more Pixel 4As. The affordable line, the A line, is really good, and it's just hard to be like, it almost feels like the 4A is the better phone, is because for the price, you're getting exactly what you expect, whereas the 5 is twice that and doesn't feel like it's twice the phone, right?
Well, it's not quite twice, is it? Like, it's 500 for the 4A 5G, right?
Well, I'm talking about the 4A, which was 350
True, yeah. And, you know, which 5G isn't everywhere. Like, 5G is still not... We're still very early days for these next-generation networks. But I'm already recommending the 4A to loads of people. It'll be interesting to see if there's just enough stock for everyone that wants 4A phones to get one.
Will you continue to recommend the Pixel 5 to your friends and family and your mom, by the way?
That's an interesting one. Hi to Engadget Superfan, my mom. She's probably listening somewhere. That's the thing. Like, can you recommend the Pixel 5? I mean, I like wireless charging. I like, you know, the color. The sage green color is beautiful. I like that as well. Mm-hmm. Water resistance, one extra camera. I think it might just depend on, we'll test these cameras and see if the Pixel 5 has a noticeably better camera experience.
Yeah.
But like the 4A had an incredible camera experience for,
and I again, mean some of the yes.
So yeah, I think I'll start absolutely recommending the 4A.
I mean, but you're getting these new features. Speaking of the cameras though, yeah, there's some new features coming, right? Like portrait light, which we've seen on iPhones and we've seen on some other, Huawei's actually made its own version of that. And it's going to be nice for me at least to play around with that feature. Night sight with portrait mode. You've got cinema pan coming as a stabilization mode for videos on the phone. So great. Would love to test them out, but it's also, these features aren't things that they need to necessarily keep on the Pixel 5. They could roll it out backwards to 4As and so on. So I mean, yeah, I wonder other than if, the fact that it doesn't have an ultra-wide camera.
That's what I was going to say. The lack of two cameras, I think, on the 4A and stuff like that will stop maybe the panning mode, which is funny because yeah. The LG Wing, which is also kind of floating around, Richard Lai is writing an impressions piece on it at the moment. The yes. Wing does that as well with its cameras. So yeah. It's very, you know, isn't it interesting how all these phones appear with nigh-on identical features?
Basically, I mean, people are running out of ideas, and
yeah.
But it's a race to see who does it better. I want to explain Extreme Battery Saver mode a little bit better, like exactly what you get for Extreme Battery Saver. So according to Google, it will let your phone's battery get an extra 48 hours depending on how you customize it. So when you turn it on, Extreme Battery Saver will change your phone's screen timeout to 30 seconds. So instead of staying on the whole time, it'll just go dark every 30 seconds, or if you're not using it for longer than 30 seconds. It will also turn off your work profile if you have something like that set up. And then it will also let you pick what apps you want to keep running while everything else is like disabled temporarily. So it sounds like you have the option of picking what runs. For me, man, I don't know. What would you keep running if you had to choose, like when your phone is dying and you want to have only two or three apps running?
God, that's tricky, right?
Right.
I'd have like some kind of audio player, whether that's music or podcast. I can probably run those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a hard one.
Do some come to mind for you?
I mean, I almost always just think Instagram, but Instagram, A, is a battery hog. B, is like frivolous. I would have Spotify, hopefully, to play my local tunes, because that's essential for me when going home on my commute and stuff. I can't think what else. Sometimes maybe maps if you're out and about and you're looking for a place. Ugh, yeah. It really depends.
There's things as well, like, you know, these days you can't just turn off Bluetooth for that slightly little bit more of battery because we're using wireless right. headphones or, you know, other peripherals where you've got a wearable that connects to your phone. There's things yeah. like that. I'm looking at Extreme Battery Saver now, seeing what kind of options. So yeah, it seems like you can very much pick and choose what this will affect.
Yeah.
But then doesn't that ruin the whole point of it?
Like, yeah, and also, yeah, and people were always like, turn on airplane mode. Like, maybe that's the way, but I don't know. Well, look, we'll have to put this to deeper testing to know, like, maybe when I have the phone in hand and I'm testing this mode out, maybe I'll know better what, like, my use cases are. Right now, I'm not going anywhere. It's not like I'm not next to a plug
yeah,
all the time.
Yeah.
So it's okay. What else? Did you have anything, like, else that jumped out at you about the 5 or the 4A 5G?
We've kind of covered the main things. Like, it's retreading a lot of ground, right? It's it's funny that, you know, the head of Google hardware said it was a flagship, or like he believed, I'm not sure how he worded and what his way around it.
Yeah, it's more that they he said that it's not impossible that Google might make, you know, higher end flagships soon. I think a lot of the people on that call with me were miffed at the fact that the processor is slower than last year's flagship model.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's not that much really exciting about it. I mean, there's this feature called Hold for Me, which helps you stay on hold with an operator on like your tech support call or when you're trying to get in touch with your bank, and using Google's Assistant AI, which, you know, powers features like duplex for restaurant reservations. I think it's going to be good and helpful, but doesn't feel like it's that great a deal? I don't know.
Here's something you might not... I think this might have happened, or at least people realized it when you clocked off for the night. Do you know that in the UK, we're getting these phones on the 15th? Well, we're getting the Pixel 5 on the 15th in the UK and several other countries. But in the US, they're not coming till the end of October.
Oh, so you guys are getting it earlier than us?
Yeah.
In retail.
Oh, it's right. It's like it's 2011 all over again.
What I saw was that people were pre-ordering today, but the ship date was October 30th, which...
That's it, yeah.
It's a special day for me. You guys are getting it a little bit earlier, 2 weeks earlier, which is, I mean, I guess good for you. Congratulations.
Good for you.
The other thing I realized is that 5G, depending on which carrier or which type of 5G you opt for when you're buying the Pixel 5 and 4A 5G, well, might cost you an extra $100.
Yes.
Which, oi, ridiculous. Mm. Verizon's exclusive white collar version is $100 more. So do you really, like, Verizon customers, are you getting a really bad deal? Requisite disclaimer that Verizon is our parent company and owns us, but has no control over editorial content.
And has never sent me a free limited edition white phone either.
Yeah, not yet, I guess, maybe.
Have you got free phones from Verizon? You're not telling me
about. I don't have free phones. I have, like, my employee phone, and I have, like, review units that Verizon will also send. You know what I mean? Those sorts of things. But anyhow, that seems like a huge deal. Like, the whole point of these phones is that you know, Google were trying to make 5G a thing, and then you've sacrificed other high-end features. Meanwhile, the 5G version that actually will improve speeds, the millimeter wave ultra wide band version, is going to cost $100 more. Like, then what was the whole point of trying to keep the price down by sacrificing some of these other features? Feels like kind of a...
Yeah, like, with you, yeah, you know, it's a running joke that you know way too much about 5G and millimeter wave and the rest of it. But, like, does it... my running joke, yeah. But isn't, like, this all a bit irrelevant until 5G is completely, like, all-encompassing and rolled out everywhere? Like, the benefits aren't that...
Go ahead.
Up front, are they? At this early stage?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that it's also for future-proofing. I think there are people who are buying phones now that they want to keep for 2 years. And so in 2 years, hopefully the coverage will be much better, and these phones that you buy today can help you get on those networks and you won't be left behind. I will say, if you're like on something like a T-Mobile where they're not using ultra-wideband, they're using sub-6, then the difference between gigabit LTE and that is like minimal. It's like a 25% boost, and you're not going to really notice 25%. You're not there on your clock, like, it's not 25% faster this download. It might not be as significant. So look, I don't know what everyone else's thoughts are on 5G, the Pixel 5 and the Pixel 4a 5G, but if you have something you want to get off your chest, make sure you send your thoughts to podcast@engadget.com.
Yeah, and tell us which one you'd buy. Would you, like, just buy the 4A, the basic? Would you get the 4A 5G?
Yeah.
Or would you buy the Pixel 5? If so, why?
Also, what color are you going to get? Probably the green.
Anyhow,
I think that's really all we can say so far about the phones before we get them and start testing them ourselves. So stay tuned for our impressions on that. Google also unveiled a new Chromecast with Google TV. Matt, do you watch TV?
Yes, I do watch TV. I watch a lot of
streaming
stuff.
There are some people who don't.
I mean, like, I think you can just about see it in the background here. Yes, I have an oversized TV, mostly streaming services because, you know, I was born in the 80s. But yeah, like, I do have a Chromecast. We'll get to what I use my Chromecast for later on. But I know they sent one to you. You've had a play, haven't you?
I've had a play with the new Chromecast, and I really like it. First of all, the physical difference is noticeable, right? I mean, before this, I was using a Chromecast, the original Chromecast stick, which was $35 only. And then I also recently, like, kicked my TV over, so I had to, like... I think I broke the original Chromecast, so I had to upgrade to a Chromecast Ultra. And that's like a disc, like a round, like a circle, but that's about 2 inches thick. Anyway, so the new Chromecast is more like a pebble almost, with its smooth finish and its kind of rounded shape. And it comes in cute colors. I've got the blue option. There's also like this coral looking color, and I think a white. But anyhow, it looks good. It looks very in line with the rest of Google's.
And the new one is $50, right? this new device.
Yeah, and I think that's the same price as the original, as the Chromecast Ultra.
Yeah.
And there's support for 4K, HDR, Dolby Vision, surround sound, all the good stuff you'd expect from a modern streaming player. But the big deal, or the two big deals anyway, with the new Chromecast is Google TV. Have you heard that name before, Matt?
Like, once upon a time, many years ago. What, have they brought it back?
Yeah, so 10 years ago.
Yeah, they did, Matt.
Yeah, you are an 80s kid. 10 years ago, Google launched this thing called Google TV with the Nexus Player. I don't know if anyone remembers that, but way back when, Google already used this name. Then Android TV became a thing that it launched a year after it, you know, announced the original Chromecast, which was, so 2013 original Chromecast, 2014 Android TV launched. So Android TV then started to replace Google TV. Well, now it looks like Google TV is going to replace Android TV again. So it's just very confusing for a lot of people who are trying to keep up with what's what. And I will try to explain it all to y'all. Basically, Google TV is this interface that makes that comes with the Chromecast and lets you like look at all your different TV shows or your movies across all your different apps like HBO, Hulu, Prime Video, etc., and Netflix. And you get recommendations based on your, you know, what you've seen across all of these different services, as well as like your watch list. You can like save stuff to one combined watch list.
That's useful,
right? Exactly, across all of these different services, which I really like. And I've been actually using this feature for a while on Play Movies and TV, which has been around for years and years. People just don't know about it. And it sucks because it's a very underrated feature. I'm glad it's getting some attention now. But yeah, so Google TV is this layer that runs on top of the OS. And the OS is going to stick around and be called Android TV still. So that's where the confusion lies. You're not going to see on your TV the words Android TV anymore. You will see the words Google TV and you'll see this new like layout. But Google's still going to keep the name Android TV around, which like a lot of people are very confused by. No, I don't know if this bothers you,
this
Matt.
This makes no sense. Like,
yeah.
Like, this is like 17 layers of Google just deciding to have, you know, a bazillion Google Meet video calls and decide how to, you know, make Google's you know streaming TV service relevant or interesting in some way. So yeah. I don't like why I don't
yeah
it's great, but so hard to care, right? So hard to care about this.
I barely care. I care about what like the user is going to experience, which is like, I mean, the other big thing I kind of mentioned was the new remote control. And this makes the, I mean, people who, like you, Matt, have been using a Chromecast and like me, know that like you're generally very reliant on your phone if you use a Chromecast or your laptop or whatever you choose. And this makes it like the new interface plus this just makes this whole thing feel more like a smart TV. And for those who already have a smart TV, like you bought a Samsung or a Roku or TCL smart TV with its OS built in, good for you. The rest of us aren't lucky enough to be, you know, and like all I got is a dumb A-word TV that I have an HDMI slot and I've stuck the dongle in and like it was like living in 2012. So now with the new Chromecast, I feel like I'm living in 2020 at last.
Yes. This is out for sale now, right, as well? I can buy one.
Yep. Yep. Do you want to go buy one? It's $50. You can buy it. Yeah, you can buy it at Home Depot last week too.
Oh, so what I wanted to come back to is what I use my Chromecast for, actually.
Yes,
is there anything
please,
else you wanted
yes
to add about the vital specs, or do you think you've covered bases?
If people have questions, they can if people have questions, they can ask us on the YouTube live chat. We will answer them when we break for a pause later on. But yeah, please tell me what you use your Chromecast
for. So mostly I play Stadia on it. Now, does this play Stadia?
It will support Stadia in the first half of 2021, but some people who've already bought the Chromecast before the announcement were already testing it out with Stadia, and they said it works.
That's such a weird... This is like when they launched Stadia, and it would only work with some Chromecast Ultras. This is very much like a back-end thing. Is this just to funnel it so that the service doesn't get overrun, or... I don't get
you mean the delay? You mean why there's a delay?
Yeah.
I don't really know either. I think it has something to do with, like you said, how they're getting the processing to happen. I don't know if they have dedicated, like, something to working on that. I have no idea why there's a delay, but that's a good question. I might ask Google after.
Yeah, like I can't understand the delay, but like, you know, if they had enough meetings to relabel Android TV as Google TV, then they probably have a good reason for delaying Stadia on their brand new streaming device. It makes no sense. Yeah. It makes no sense.
I know. Anyway, so stay tuned for our deeper review on that. But if you already want some pretty detailed impressions, my hands-on is up on Engadget.com. Just kind of my experience after 2 days with this thing. So last thing that Google unveiled were new speakers, which we were expecting. And I think the big surprise there is the name is Nest Audio. No longer are we going to use the Google Home brand for their speakers. Nest Audio. And there's a big focus, as you can tell from the name, that audio quality is their whole thing now. Matt, what speaker do you use?
What speaker do I use?
If at all.
I am afraid to say ones in case they pick up that I'm talking at them. I have...
Use another name for it.
Yeah. I have two HomePods, Apple HomePods, one in the bedroom, one in, well, I guess the lounge. It's kind of an all-in-one apartment here. Mm-hmm. Then I have a Google Mini, Google Home Mini, I think, to use the right terms. The Coral one, which is beautiful, in my bedroom as well. Oh. And then I have a Google Home Hub in my kitchen. And then I think my Sonos does, I'm looking around the room if you hear my audio fade in and out. I think I have my Sonos does smart assistant nonsense as well. So yeah, all of them apart from Amazon Alexa, which
I've got a very good. Yeah, you've got a good setup. I'm the non-Apple end of that conversation where I have all the things you just said minus Sonos, but I have Amazon's Echo speaker. So what is your preferred? Like, what do you think in terms of music quality? What would you play music on? Let's say take the Sonos out of the equation, though.
Yeah, oh, definitely the HomePod, which makes sense. It costs so much more than the others, but definitely the HomePod. Like, I used to have both of them set up, like, side by side to my TV, and playing music then in stereo mode, it just sounded absolutely incredible. I had the Max, the Nest Home Max, I think that was called, the big smart speaker.
The big screen.
That sounded, No, not the big screen one, the one that was just
the
speaker, beefy
Home
speaker.
Max, the Google
Home Max, yeah. Now, that sounded great as well. That was very impressive. But yeah, like, I have smart speaker malaise now. Like, they don't do enough, do they? Like, I think the main aim is what do you want it for? Like, if you want decent audio quality, use that to specify which speaker you buy. But the other ones, like these minis, like the Nest Mini, that will suffice for 90% of your smart home tasks and what you want from a smart assistant.
Yeah. I think for me, we were talking on the live stream yesterday after the Google event that I have both the Amazon Echo and the Home, and I generally prefer the hot word in case my assistant wakes up and tries to ask me what I want. Anyway, the Echo has somehow better music quality, I think, than my Google Home. But so I am excited to see what Nest Audio will deliver. I mean, they've improved some of the drivers and the subwoofers. And also Google uses some pretty good software to tune the music output like it did on the Nest Mini.
Can you say subwoofer again, please?
Subwoofer? Why?
You said subwoofer.
What? We know my accent's all over the place because I'm from all over the world. It's fine. But anyway,
Sorry.
But no, it's okay. The thing about the Nest Audio is it comes in at $99. It sounds like it's going to provide music quality that Mark Ronson was very on board with, by the way, apparently. So I am excited to hear it for myself. I just don't think that I can say much until I have these to test.
Yeah, this is the curse of all of these remote events, right? Unless you, like, we got the Chromecast at least to play with ahead of time. But yeah, without testing, there isn't much to say that we're not parroting from either our own experience or the press release. One other thing I want to add about the Nest Audio is, like the Apple's HomePods, you are able to pair them, right? So you can make up a little stereo pair to make them sound even better. And that would be, what,
excited for that.
$200 all in then for like a stereo audio setup, which isn't bad.
It's not bad at all. So really, the crucial thing now would be to see what kind of quality you're getting for that price, right? For the stereo pairing and the $200. Is it Sonos level? I don't know. Is it Sony level? I don't know either. The other thing that Google demoed during its event too was like this big stage setup where they had different speakers peppered around the space. And then this music artist just walking around saying, yo, assistant, play the music on this speaker instead, play on that speaker instead. Like, it made it seem like it was moving along with him, even though it was really hard to tell on video, like, if the music really was playing through, like, a specific speaker. But this multi-room audio idea is something that Google has talked about before, and it seems like they're going to try to find a way to make all your speakers that are Google-powered play at the same time to give you this really immersive experience. Does that sound like a nightmare to you, Matt, or like...
Actually, it sounds ideal, because like I said, like I have a... I mean, what? I've only got like 4 rooms in my apartment, but like...
What?
I have
4 rooms?
Well, I'm including like the corridor room that goes from the bathroom
luxury.
Yeah, such luxury. Anyway, the point is, I have a Google device in my bedroom and I have a Google device in my lounge, living, dining, kitchen room. So it would be kind of cool to like, because I do have to kind of bark orders to turn off lights and turn off speakers.
Right.
Like whatever this kind of room-based detection is, if it could also switch off lights, that would be pretty cool.
That's the thing, is that it doesn't seem like they're sensing where you're at in the space just yet. It seems like you still have to shout commands at the speaker to get it to, like, play on the next one, or now I'm in my bedroom.
That's what I'm doing now. That's dumb.
I know. I don't know yet. Maybe they'll have more details to share on how that works. But it would be super cool if they were able to sense your presence and just, like, turn on the music wherever you walk and turn on your lights, right? That's, like, smart home goals.
Yeah, very much so. Like, it seems like I'm absolutely dogging on Google and everything they've announced.
You're not alone. I think that the grand recap of the overall event is that a lot of people on our live stream seemed to leave disappointed. Nobody on our live stream, which tends to be a lot of like gadget hardcore fans anyway, none of them were impressed by the smart home stuff, and none of them liked the Pixel 5. Except for a few who pre-ordered already, and they were going to pre-order regardless.
Yeah,
anyway,
irrespective of whatever they announced. Yeah, I think maybe the problem is that the 4A was already announced and kind of stole a lot of the thunder here. Like, I'm going to talk about it later on this podcast, but it's a great phone. Sure, it's a bit boring in black, but like the capability and how it looks like a next gen phone.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's edge-to-edge screen, pinhole camera, incredible cameras on the back. And you get all that with the 4A, 5G, and the 5, but you have to pay a lot more money to do that.
I agree. I mean, I think Google shot itself in the foot a little bit by releasing the 4A 5G in tandem with the 5, because then now it's like, what do you pick? Overall, though, it seems like everyone's biggest compliment to Google for the event was how short it was.
Yes.
Everyone was like, 30 minutes, yay, bye. Which I don't know if it's a bad sign, but...
I think it's indicative of all these remote press conferences we've seen and had to sit through. Like, Samsung's pretty guilty of it. Apple's pretty guilty of it.
Yes. Google did tell me ahead of the launch that this was going to be short, sweet, and they know that no one wants to... they've listened to feedback that no one wants to sit through long things like that anymore. So I think they kept it short for a reason. But despite still keeping it short, they were able to squeeze in a long rap about all the channels you get on YouTube Live, which I found actually impressive. Like, my jaw dropped as they, like, did that rap. It was fun to watch, I guess.
I mean, producer Ben, can we cut in some of that for the podcast? Let's go. We got ABC, we got ACC, Adult Swim, Animal Planet, and AMC. You can watch BBC, America, World News, BET, and Bravo. Why you eating nachos? The chips are looking salty, man. You need a little cheddar. We got Big Ten Network, Cartoon Network, CBS, and Cheddar. We got CMT. So there you have it. It's like the main takeaway from the Google event was that short and sweet, rap, and then ultimately the products were kind of just expected. Food Network to brush up on your recipes, too. Fox and Freeform, FS1 and FS2. Oh, yes, not one, not two, but 3 channels by FX. Dolphin, HD. So enough about Google. Let's talk about some even more immediate news. Just this morning, today's Thursday, Microsoft announced a handful of new updates.
Yeah, it is. It was like, great job, Microsoft. We didn't need news, extra news this week, but thank you. However, the good news is these things seem very straightforward. There's nothing too complex here. There's a new Surface Laptop Go, which is adorable. And then the Surface Pro X got a new processor. That's the high-level overview And I mean, there's also some new accessories that you can check out Engadget.com for all the details on. But yeah, Matt, what are you thinking? I know you're not, I don't think you're a PC user, are you?
No, it's about time I kind of got back into it. But I'd like for you to like help me out here. How do I separate the Surface Laptop Go from the Surface Go 2? Or even the Surface Go.
Indeed.
Like, what's the difference here?
Yes. So here you go. The Surface is the Surface as a line are tablets first. They're the ones with the kickstands built in, right? So the Surface Laptop is that clamshell that like with the keyboard attached sort of style. So the Surface Go was that 10-inch cute, tiny little tablet with a very kind of weak processor to start off with, but it's super affordable and also even cuter than the Laptop Go. The Surface Laptop Go is like the mini version of the Surface Laptop 3. And it's got, instead of the 13-inch and 15-inch models that the Laptop 3 is available in, you'll have this 12.4-inch screen. So it's very reminiscent of, remember the baby MacBook, the 12-inch MacBook that recently got,
the original MacBook. Plain, no Air, no Pro.
No additional word at the end of its name. Yeah. That I bought, the only MacBook that I ever bought for myself.
There you go.
It's more or less the same as that. And also, I think the MateBook 13. But anyway, so it's really cute. And it comes in two new colors. One of them is this ice blue is the name for it, but it's just this really pretty, almost pastel blue. And then there's also this like copperish goldish color, and I can't remember the exact name for it, but it's also attractive. So it's just an option, I think, that's good for someone that doesn't want something too big or powerful. And it starts at $549, which for a Surface laptop,
wow.
I think,
yeah,
is not bad at all. For that price, you're getting a 10th generation Intel Core i5 to start with. And I mean, like the full details, like how much RAM, you can go up to 16 gigs of RAM, but obviously that'll cost more. 256 gigs of storage will also cost you more. But I mean, this is a nice introduction to what Microsoft's Surface laptops can offer. And I've recommended the Surface laptops in general as an alternative to the Dell XPS line for a while. Devendra's always like, anytime you ask Devendra what PC to get, Devendra's like, XPS, this and that.
Yeah.
XPS!
Yeah.
Devendra XPS hardware. But I'm like, look, not everyone wants to get an XPS. Sometimes someone wants something with a different look. And this, I think, the Laptop Go with its new colors and this cute little size that the XPS line doesn't have, offers like another option for someone looking for something a bit different.
I mean, like, I'm reading Devendra's write-up now of this new Laptop Go, and he's like, it's still not as, the bezels aren't as thin as the Dell's XPS 13. I'm like, give it up, Devendra. We get it, okay? We get it. I mean, he's not wrong, but also this is a $550 laptop. This isn't a $1,000 notebook.
Exactly.
He's not wrong.
The bezels are indeed not as thin, but they're pretty thin. Looking at the pictures, to be clear, we haven't touched these devices or seen them in person. So I'm only really going off of videos and pictures that Microsoft has sent. But they're not the chunky bezels from years past. These look modern. They have a 3:2 aspect ratio. And, you know, Microsoft's Pixel Sense screen has been good. Now, the one concern for laptops that are that small in general is that their keyboards are usually not up to par. And I don't know how much time you've spent with like a MacBook 12-inch keyboard, Matt. They were pretty terrible. But yeah, Microsoft is like, we have a full-size keyboard and we've got like a big trackpad. So it'll be nice to see like what the keyboard experience is on the Surface Laptop Go being so small.
Yeah, well, can I just say, Sherlyn, that was an incredibly comprehensive walk through everything. I'm very impressed.
I mean, I still have one last thing to tell you about.
Let me put my chin on both my hands then. Tell me more.
Yes. For that size also, right, another concern is battery life. But Microsoft is promising like up to 13 hours of juice on this thing. So it, again, I have to see it in person, see how chunky, heavy, and you know, sizey this thing is.
How sizey is it? That's a great question.
Sizey. It's a good game to play in our downtime. Anyway, but yes, the potential for this device to be really good is there. I want to check it out as soon as possible. And yeah, $549, a great starting price. Almost like half, slightly more than half of the Surface Laptop 3 starting price.
Could you say it's the Pixel 4a of Windows laptops?
I can't say that yet because I haven't tested it, but it might be. Wow, that's a very good like analogy for the really hardcore tech nerds.
Yeah, like
because like four imagine people. If I wrote that in my review, right? Yeah. If I wrote that in my review and someone like my neighbor reads it, they're like, "What is the Pixel 4a?"
Yeah, well, it's Engadget readers. You know, they know these things.
Yeah, Engadget readers are smarter than the average.
Yeah.
I don't mean smarter. I mean more informed. Anyhow, that wasn't the only thing that Microsoft announced. It also announced new updates to the Surface Pro X, which, Matt, I don't know if you recall. Do you recall what that thing is?
No.
Not at all.
Honest.
I know. See,
I'll be honest. No.
I mean, go for it. The Surface Pro X was introduced last year. It was Microsoft's own Windows on Snapdragon thing, like a convertible. So
yes.
It's a 2-in-1. Yeah. The hardware is incredible. It's super thin. It's really premium. It looks really good. It's got a nice screen. The original version used Microsoft's SQ1 chipset, which it created in collaboration with Qualcomm. And this year, with today's news, Microsoft is saying, hey, we have a new chip. It's the SQ2. And they're not really sharing exactly what the differences are between the SQ1 and the SQ2. But if it's anything to go on, like if Qualcomm's own generational chipset upgrades are anything to go on, I don't think there's that much of a speed difference in terms of the processor. But yeah, that's the main, I think, big news out of the Surface Pro X, that a new configuration is available with the SQ2 chipset. You can get all the details once again on Engadget.com. I have a write-up. But also the other new thing with the Surface Pro X is a new color option. Hey!
It's all about the color
silver,
options.
It's all about the colors this year. The silvery platinum finish is the new... default one of the new colors you can get the tablet itself in. So there's two options now, the black or the silver platinum thing. And then the signature keyboard cover now comes in that same sky ice blue that I really like, as well as the red and the standard black. So those are the new things. I mean, some of the other features are like software based, and you know, Windows on ARM is struggling, but you know, have you had any experience with Windows on ARM devices, Matt?
No, I've never heard anything good about it, so I try to avoid it when possible. But yeah, like it's
I
not,
mean, you
it's
main like a MacBook,
yet.
Right?
Sorry?
It's not. No. Your main driver laptop is an Apple, right?
Yeah, MacBook Pro, yeah.
It's a MacBook. There you go. So I think it's an interesting like device, ARM-based PCs. I used to be super excited for them. I still am hopeful that they'll do good. I want to see what Microsoft was able to do with its own chip. Maybe it was different from the 8cx Gen 2 in some way, and that there actually are speed differences. But again, I'll need to like take it to real world testing to know. But they've also bumped up the battery life estimate from 13 hours to 15 hours. So, you know, that's nice to see. Maybe that's what the processor improvement is. So, y'all, tell me if you're excited for this thing, because it's hard to be excited anymore when Windows on ARM still needs so much work. So this week, Matt, your review of iOS 14 went up on Engadget.com. What do you feel overall about this new update?
I think it's pretty refreshing. Like, I don't know, when it comes to testing out an iOS update, right? Like, it's hard to derive exactly what changes between all the numbers, unless it's like, you know, remember when they got rid of the home button? It was kind of, you know, game-changing and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
huge, huge differences. The last couple of years hasn't really been that kind of thing. Like, they've just been refining, honing, making it all work like, you know, it should. But yeah, iOS 14, Well, to be honest, Sherlyn, you're an Android fangirl. It gives you everything you might want or need on iOS.
Yeah.
Like, it gives you so many features that we've had on Android for years. Like, off the top of my head, like picture-in-picture video, widgets, like an app drawer of a sort, like just the kind of, eminently useful features that we haven't seen in iOS. And now they're here.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, the main thing I think that people have been experiencing that's new with iOS 14 are these like new widgets and allowing you to customize your home screens more freely or have more options to. And people have been posting guides on how to do that on iOS 14 all over the internet, on TikTok or on Twitter that I've seen. And yeah, the other thing I've been seeing pop up on my Twitter timelines is everyone showing off their iOS 14 home screen aesthetic. Aesthetic. Which, like, I will say, having, I mean, we've had these on Android for a while, and honestly, we've all, I feel like, generally cycled back to, like, standard home screen with icons and no, not a lot of real widgets, but that depends, maybe power users still have them. Anyway, it's fun to see, like, iOS users now going, oh, this is great, I can create this really thing, and I'm like, yo, we've gone there and come back already, like, welcome, come back to us later. I will say, though, these images that people are posting of their home screens look a lot nicer than I ever seen on Android. It's weird. It's weird. Maybe just people are more creative or more about that look on,
so do you,
on Apple.
So do you know why this is happening now? Do you want a little bit of explanation about why, like, there's a sudden,
sure,
like,
yes,
aesthetic push?
Please Mattsplain it to me. Mattsplain.
I'll try. Mattsplain. It's the Mattsplain segment. Jingle. Hit the jingle.
Dun, 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 dun.
Mattsplain. So alongside, like, these widgets now, which include, like, you can have, like, a full, you know, a screen encompassing photo widget that has, like, your prettiest photos on display,
right,
or weather widgets or calendars, the rest of it. And there's also third party, right, ones, which adds this own aesthetic again. But you can, right, now with iOS 14, you can kind of uniquely tweak with the image files for icons,
yeah,
and kind of,
yeah,
ascribe your own ones. And that means you can just kind of go bonkers like you could on Android devices. Like, you can very much just choose any,
yeah,
kind of image and slap it on any kind of app, you know, whether it's an internal Apple, you know, native app or Chrome, mm-hmm, or Maps or Spotify. And so you can literally make any kind of aesthetic. You can make it kind of, you know, a mosaic photo that joins together. You can, you know, have a unified kind of nature theme. I'm looking at an absolutely bonkers superhero one where they have a different super, different Marvel superhero for, like, every,
oh,
icon.
You know,
but
how I,
yeah,
love that.
And there's something, I think there's something nice. I agree with what you were saying, like, Android people have come full circle. Like, yeah, we went completely wacky a few years ago and would, like,
yes,
and remember, like, you know, like, I imagine, I can totally recall LG as a particular example offering their own kind of aesthetic builds where it would, you know, they were skins, weren't they? You called them skins.
Yeah, there were so many.
And
LG had its own, Samsung,
yeah,
had its own, HTC had Sense, you know?
Yeah, and it would unify all the icons and kind of, you know, splash them all with the,
right,
same paint and the same kind of,
yes,
aesthetic logic and stuff. So it's really weird to,
yes,
see iPhones doing it now. I mean, is it retro? I feel like it's a retro thing to do.
It's retro in the way that, like, fashion brings back retro every once in a while, but adds a new fresh spin. So it is kind of retro, but still feels new. I think especially to iOS users who have been faced with the same screen for so long, now being able to play around and have that freedom is fun. I want to go quickly into, like, what iOS 14 does offer that Android doesn't get yet, but want to point out that when we were on our production call talking about iOS 14 with our video team for this show, everyone on our video team is, like, iOS people, so not trying to judge, but I'm trying to judge. Everyone is an iPhone user, and no one on our team, it seems like, has downloaded iOS 14 just yet. And I think that's,
whoa,
wise. I think that, okay, so one of them who's on the stream now just chimed in to say that they have and that it's good. I think Julio was the one who chimed in, and he thinks he's a techie, so maybe that's why he downloaded it ahead of time.
He thinks, ouch.
Most people.
Oh, God.
Most people, I think, don't jump on software updates as quickly as we do.
Mm.
So if you're out there listening to this podcast, you're probably an early adopter. But if you have friends who haven't, maybe show them your aesthetic. Convince them that this is the whole point of, you know, getting iOS 14. But yeah, there's some other features on iOS 14, right?
There's a few. There's a lot actually to kind of, like, chew over.
Soundboard.
Yeah. That's the thing, though. You know, when you do these reviews and your brain is just 24/7 thinking about this topic. So let's, like, talk about my favorite thing. So
yes,
there's huge upgrades, obviously, with the widgets and with app organization, and it refreshes the whole experience. Now, on top of that, you have genuine, you know, feature additions. Now, I loved picture-in-picture video, which I've already mentioned, and now this is a big one. The ability to choose default apps for your email client and web browser.
Yes.
Now, this is
good
stuff.
Yes.
I'm a Chrome and a Gmail user, so they went immediately onto default. And yeah, it's just so nice to, like, have my process set. Like, I open things in Chrome because, you know, it's on my PC. I have my add-ons and my widgets. I have my bookmarks. I have my passwords manager. it all smooths better when I know I'm opening a link into Chrome and not Safari. And now it does it for me, so I don't have to like awkwardly try and copy and paste from the address bar, open the Chrome app, copy and paste it in, have to re-log in again and just have myself have a headache just for using my phone.
Welcome to what Android has had for a while, but
tell me about it. So I did those changes immediately. I really hope Apple kind of walks this further. Like, I hope they kind of bring, I mean, every review you'll read about iOS 14 says the same thing, like bring maps. Like, I don't want to open Apple Maps. Give me Google Maps. But I was thinking 100%. Things like notes. I'd love notes to be like other kind of organization and productivity services. That would be very cool to save it into like, I'm trying to think of the Google equivalent. They have their own kind of notes-esque.
Keep
is exactly what I'm thinking of. Google Keep. Or hey, even like Evernote or some Dropbox functionality. There's lots that Apple could do with this to make it even more kind of power user friendly. And that's what it feels like. It feels like a lot of this is great power user stuff, but a lot of it is good for dumb people like me. Do you want me to go on?
Yes, please keep going. Why are you a dumb person? I would love to.
It's the blonde hair. It's mostly the blonde hair. It's just disguised by the British accent. Yeah, I never graduated high school.
I have nothing to add to that. I really don't think I can chime in.
So why is iOS 14 good for stupid people like me? Or maybe lazy is a better word. Now, it's probably Siri. Like, Siri got good. Siri got smarter. Okay. So there's like, alongside one of these widgets, there's one called Smart Stacks. And this means you can kind of overlap widgets on top of each other, because you don't always need the weather widget. You need it when you need it. And then, you know, show me battery life, show me news headlines. So with Smart Stacks, you can kind of layer them on top of each other if they're compatible sizes. And then, you know, you have the ability to cycle through them. On top of that, with Siri and like machine learning, the phone, as you use it, will start to kind of automatically shuffle the cards up. The ones you will need to see or would see, it automatically bubbles them up later. There's even one that does this with like an app. There's like a Siri suggestions widget that is at its biggest size, looks just like eight normal app icons. But these are like automatically generated. They're like algorithmically known to be the ones you're going to use or want to use at that, either that time of day. Or I've seen it stimulated by when I disconnect Bluetooth or leave the house. The best example I wrote in the review is like whenever I left my house at midday to go to the gym, my like HIIT timer app would automatically pop up in my notifications saying, "Do you want to launch this now?" And that this is the clever stuff. This is the kind of predictive, you know, smartphones I want to see. Oh, smartphones! See what I did there. Like that's this, you know, these are the kind of things where it's doing half the job for me. Like, bring the feature before I know I need it. Like, you have the knowledge, you know how I use my phone. You know, for arguably I use my phone for way too many hours each day. Like, inform that. You know, design the phone around how I use it. It's it's really refreshing and very cool. Like, this is very much like initial steps, but I find it exciting. Am I too excited? I think I might be.
Maybe. But it's okay. It's okay to get excited. Because I even am excited for this, because Google has done stuff like that, like suggested apps and whatever in your apps drawer, or even a suggested row of apps in Android 11. I've never found them to be all that useful or clever. They've just never surfaced the right apps for me. So it sounds like these widgets or the Smart Stacks or Siri suggestions seem to be at least understanding your behavior on your phone better. And I need to go and like figure out if I'm, you know, maybe not doing something right with Android.
Just to follow on from that, I have been using iOS 14 in the beta as well. So it probably has a lot more information. Although, were you using Android 11 in kind of...
I was using Android 11 in beta for a while, and then I was using the full Android 11 before my review went up for a bit. And it's still, I mean, it's not even just Android 11 specific. It's overall Android, right? The whole suggestions software or system in there, it's still not as smart as I'd like it to be. Like that use case that you talked about with the hit timer coming up once you leave the house never happens to me. Like,
that's because you don't do anything and you don't leave the house, though.
Right now, it's true, yes. But it should be smart enough to know, because like I almost always at the same time every day launched my yoga app to cast a workout to TV or something, right? And you could always surface that app like near the right time.
So that's
time
still
of day,
not popping up for you?
In part because also the way I use my apps is like I search them directly from the homepage anyway. You know what I mean? Like I just pull down the search.
It should still know these things, shouldn't it? It should know you're launching that program, right?
Right. So I feel like there's a lot of work to do. The other thing, too, that I want to point out that Android doesn't have that iOS 14 brings is, I mean, you've always had iMessages. I love iMessage. Like,
really?
That was the hardest thing for me when quitting Apple that I did 5 or 6 years ago. And I had to, like, give up on all my iMessage group chats. And back then, I was into group chats. Like, well, I am into it now, too. But anyway, the fun thing during your review was that we had to get on an iMessage group chat because I was also reviewing the Apple Watch at the same time, so I had my iPhone going. And we could change the name of the group, I think. We could also change the icon, which is new. And these are, like, very minimal, like, tweaks to iMessage. They're not the hugest. But you could also thread messages, I guess. And I think it was a little bit confusing. In fact, you were a little annoyed when I kept replying to a thread, apparently. Was that annoying for you? Like, is this a feature you wish wasn't there?
No, like, these are all good features, but it all plays catch up. But this is one of those we've already been talking about, you know, we're from different mm-hmm. countries and stuff. But in the UK,
yes.
Everyone swears by WhatsApp. Like, I know mm-hmm. you're quite a heavy Telegram user. And yeah, messages mm-hmm. just, like, it exists here and people use it, but it's definitely not the big
yeah.
messaging king it is in other countries. Like,
yeah.
So a lot of these features to me were like, yeah, I've seen this before. I've seen this either on Android messages or WhatsApp or Telegram yeah. or even Line, like, if you want to go crazy. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, like, it means it stacks up better against its rivals. So it's all good stuff. But again, it's nothing it's nothing to get too hype about, I don't think.
But it's still better than Android messages.
It is then. You still feel it is.
It still is because RCS is here, but it's still not really the dream that I really wanted it to be. The nice thing about things like iMessage and Android messages is that you don't need to have your friend install something else to be able to talk to them, right? You just yeah. need their phone number or their contact information. And that's why these built-in apps, it is so important to get them better. Yes, there are a plethora of other options out there for chatting on, but you still have that added step of making, like, I love Telegram, but I can't get all the people I want to be on Telegram. Like, I still need to, like, find alternative means to talk to people sometimes, which is hella annoying. Y'all just get on Telegram if you want to talk to me. But I also have to talk to you on WhatsApp, which is annoying. I'm like, ugh. My WhatsApp has a notification. Must be Matt. Has got to be Matt.
It might be Brian.
It's either Brian or Matt, or my family. But there you go. Anything else about iOS 14 we should, kind of pay attention to?
Let me think. I'm trying to think of, like, the main things. There's so much to kind of chew over.
I know.
I think one thing I found is a lot of the features are kind of hidden away. Now, this is a very Apple thing, I think. But unless you're, like, totally, you know, you've read, like, if you're, you know, an Apple device reviewer, you've read the kind of Apple sanctioned reviewer guide or, you know, yeah. watch the entirety of WWDC. So, you know, absolutely every new iOS feature. But a lot of it is yeah. just squirreled away. They have a tips app that is okay. It's mm-hmm, very, it's a lot broader. It just teaches you, you know, skills for iOS, period. Not any kind of particular version of iOS. So a lot of the time, like, you wouldn't know these things unless you sort them out. Like, the translation app is a great new addition. Now, this does on-device translation if you remember to download the language packet. So if you're thinking of using it when you next travel somewhere, which might be quite a while from now. But you need to download these language packs ahead of time. But once you do, you have, like, a magical audio-based translator you can type in as well in all these major core languages. I think there's about 12 languages at the moment. But it's impressive. It's good. It works good with my Japanese. It worked on my not great French and German. It worked with Brian. We just mentioned Brian O, our video producer guy in New York. Yes. It worked with his Korean. It's pretty impressive. I mean, Google used to be the king. Well, is, I'd say, still the king of...
Still is, yes.
Yeah, language translation.
I was going to shout that out. Like, again, another thing that welcome to Android, which, you know, Google rolled out better translation services recently, but it has always had pretty good translation tools. Even on the phones, you just have to pull up a separate app. But now it's better baked in, I think, into apps like Maps or Assistant and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's nice to see you have this feature available for iOS as well.
Yeah, like, just any kind of translation that's on device makes it more likely for you to use it when you're actually on vacation. You know, when you just don't want to use data because you're afraid you're going to get billed forever.
And
it's a great feature to see. I think, the main takeaways are, better home screens, more, you know, your phone doesn't look like the iPhone did in 2007. Now it looks modern. It gives you information you need. And that's, like, you know, we're in 2020 now. This is what you should expect from an Apple smartphone.
Yeah.
And then the other one is Siri making, you know, Siri getting to a point where it's relevant and useful. Yeah, it's not perfect, of course, but it's getting a lot better.
So your iOS review went up this week, Matt, but what else have you been working on?
Well, that's a great question, Sherlyn. Because half the time I don't know what I'm working on. So what have I been doing recently? I've also been playing with the Apple Watches. So I'm sorry I missed out on your talk last week. So testing them out. I'm taking a few photos here and there. Loving Apple Watches. I can only use one at a time. I have the Apple Watch SE and the Apple Watch Series 6. So I've got the 6 on at the moment. And yeah,
would love to know what you think is the better one, because I think...
Interesting, yeah.
Whether the SE is enough is a question. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's the thing. But I think given that I've had a Series 5 before, I don't think I could pedal back too much to the SE. But for most people, that's a very interesting watch. Apart from that, what else am I working on this week? I'm always feeling so busy, but... Maybe I'm not busy. Maybe I should be fired. Obviously, every day I'm doing the Engadget the Morning After newsletter. Please subscribe. Yes. TMA@Engadget.com. Email me. TMA is also an anagram of Matt, so it's very easy to remember.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I can't say remember, though. And then I've got the Morning Edition podcast, which is a different podcast to this. So that keeps me going for half the day. In the afternoons, I'm editing people. So I've got some cool stories from the other UK guys, Nick Summers, Dan Cooper. Steve Dent also reviews some cameras, so he's reviewing some cameras for us at the moment. So that's my day. I'm afraid I haven't got anything specific to tell you about now.
That's totally cool. That's what your job is. And, you know, I never ever think that you're not doing any work, so don't worry about that.
I think that's a compliment.
I'm not going to tell on you to our overlords.
Okay,
I've been working on, as per usual, listeners of this podcast will know, I'm always working on top secret stuff. So more stuff I can't tell you about. But by the time this podcast goes live, you can check out Engadget.com for something else that is like under wraps that you'll see very soon. Some interesting stuff around ethics and mental well-being, that sort of stuff. So yeah, keep it locked. We obviously are also about to head straight into reviews season, so there will be a lot of devices that we're going to review soon. Stay tuned for all of that before you buy anything, you know. And also Apple's iPhone event's probably going to come up soon, so I think we're all in like prep mode for that. We don't have an actual date, but we're good preppers. We you know, believe in preparing for the future. Anyhow, speaking of preparing yourself, we also need to relax once in a while. And Matt, you prepared some recommendations for us. What are you telling people to check out this week?
What would you like? Give me a flavor. I'm sure I have a recommendation for anything.
Flavor. Matcha.
Matcha. Matcha flavor. That's my Engadget pick. Matcha flavor. Yeah.
Matcha. Matcha. M-A-T. Matcha for tea. Okay, that was not as funny as I thought. What is your real recommendation? Let's go.
I mean, it's a bit lame because we've been talking about it half the podcast, and I was talking to you about it just before we kick this off. But the Pixel 4a, this is like an incredible little phone. Like I got it a bit later than the US team. I missed a kind of review rush. Oh, well. I've been playing with
Thanks
it now.
Thanks for your help.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's an incredible little phone. Like we're saying, like, the price point and the specs and how it looks, you're getting so much bang for your buck here. Like, it's
talking
hard
about the original 4A, right?
Not yes, the 4A. 5G, yeah. I mean, not the 5G. Like, you could wait till next year for a 5G phone, I would argue.
Yeah, probably.
A headphone jack, again, that Pixel camera, which is just so reliable. It might not be the complete best, but a lot of these completely best camera phones are only the best when they're in the hands of the pros. If you give a Pixel phone to Engadget superfan, my mom, Julie Smith, she will still take incredible photos because the Pixel does half the work for her. Like,
so
it's
she's
so
a great
reliable.
Photographer now.
Oh, yeah. Well, she uses an iPhone most of the time, but I have a Pixel nearby. So when we had a family gathering recently, and when it came time to take photos of my adorable baby niece, shout out to Etta if she's listening. She definitely isn't. She's 7 months
old. She's definitely listening. She is listening.
She's in our hearts. but when it came to taking photos there, like I could pass my Pixel to anyone in my family and know we'd get a really nice, you know, family photo without any need for me to kind of handhold or take the photo myself, that kind of thing.
That's awesome. That's a good recommendation for people who are looking for a phone for not too much money. I am going to recommend our usual pop culture entertainment recommendations. However, since DaVinci's not here, Don't tell Devendra, but I watched his recommendation from last week because I never watch his recommendations. But last week he recommended this show on Amazon Prime called Utopia, and it's as good as he says. It holds up. It's very wild. But my actual recommendations are, and I forget what order I was going to tell them in. But okay, so one of them, and I on this show I try to like own the Asian horror genre. God, my accent's all over the place again. Asian horror movies are my whole thing. And so this week, I'm starting off with this Korean flick called Svaha, The Sixth Finger. I don't really know how to pronounce that first word. It's S-V-A-H-A, Svaha. Svaha? Swaha? I have no clue. The Sixth Finger. It's not really supernatural, but it's slightly supernatural. I'm a big fan of like anything with ghosts and science fiction and fantasy. And this is right there. It's about a religious cult worshiping four deity type things. And then, but they're going around killing girls because they believe one girl is some sort of big enemy or something. Big enemy energy. So anyhow, it's really typical of like recent Korean films where there's this underdog story involved, but there's also this like criminal procedural element to it, and then also some hints at supernatural stuff going on. I really liked it. It was a big mood. It was really mysterious. It felt great. I don't know if you spend a lot of time watching Asian movies anymore, Matt, but this is available on Netflix. I think you might be able to check it out in the UK as well. I don't know if you watch actually ghost shows, but
I'll have a look if it's on UK Netflix. We do get a different flavor of Netflix.
You do. But I mean, if you have, I would recommend you check it out because I like this sort of stuff. The other recommendation is something a lot more light, but still very supernatural, but really freaking hilarious. You must have heard of this show. Everyone, I think, has heard of this show. People have hyped it up, and I've just refused to watch it until recently. It's called What We Do in the Shadows.
Yes.
Have you heard
of
it?
Of course, yeah.
It is so good. It is like is another level. It's a whole other level. It's like it's a comedy series on Hulu here in America. And I've heard so much about how good it is. It's deadpan humor. It's very like low-key. The budget seems not too high. Like the production value isn't super. There's no special effects for a lot of things. But the humor and the writing is ridiculous. The characters are all just these like pathetic actual vampires, but they're like, we're so great, mwah ha ha, and then like a light blinks in the background. That sort of juxtaposition
schlocky
of what
kind
they're
of
saying. Yeah, it's hilarious.
You know it's based on a movie, right, by Taika Waititi.
It sounds so familiar.
Yeah, it's based, was a movie and then a spin-off TV series.
Thank you. I like what he does, Taika Waititi, so yeah. I can't pronounce his name either. I am so sorry.
I think he's involved with the TV series as well, so.
Oh, good. I mean, the TV stuff he's worked on, I think he was involved in Community, too, and Community is really great.
Ooh,
so, yeah. So anyway, What We Do in the Shadows, if you want something laugh out loud funny, like, honestly, like, I didn't think I was in the mood to laugh when I accidentally started watching What We Do in the Shadows. But, like, I just let it play on in the background, and I just couldn't stop, like, laughing. It was ridiculous. So that's for you to relax to, dear listener and viewer. Hopefully something that will cheer you up amid all of this bleakness that is going on. And that's it for the episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Matt online at
Twitter at ThatMattSmith. That's Matt with one T.
And if you need me, you want to tell me about all these shows that I'm never going to watch until 2 years later, I'm at Sherlyn Lowe on Twitter as well. Email us your thoughts and feedback at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes, and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify. Send us up woofers.